Welcome to After Hours at the Radio Book Club, which is a podcast, a collaboration between KGMU and the Boulder Bookstore. I'm Maeve Conran. As always, my co-host is Arsene Keshkashian of the Boulder Bookstore. And please do check out the broadcast edition of the interview that we have done with our guest this month, which is Elam Abila and his book Travellers, an incredibly powerful collection of stories about travelers, migrants, refugees, asylum seekers in Europe. And we're delighted to have Elon join us here after hours at the Radio Book Club. You write so viscerally about the boats, and I think the boats and the drownings in the Mediterranean have been just the epitome of human tragedy. So for people who don't understand or don't necessarily fully get what's happening, what the reality is for people who are getting on these overcrowded boats, often from, to cross sometimes not a very wide stretch of land. I mean, it's like between Greece or Italy, sometimes Libya, North Africa. Take us through that. And was that something that, how did you get those visceral details? I mean, did you go to some of those points yourself and talk to people? I mean, because you write incredibly about it. You're right there.
Well, I didn't have to go, even though, of course, I had, seen the Mediterranean, I had been on a boat, So basically, but most importantly, I had interviewed the people. It's their words. I actually didn't change a lot from what they told me. And the memories, the details are so fresh in their minds because they have lived this thing and they're living it every day. That's their experience. Most of them have lost loved ones in the Mediterranean, so how can they forget that? So it's and I try to use the Mediterranean Sea as a kind of metaphor, for that border between the known, what they know in their previous life, to what they are going to find out, the unknown in Europe. I mean, imagine these people never been anywhere, some of them outside their country. But now here they are crossing into Europe, where they're so different in any way you can imagine from the people of Europe. And here they are. It must take a lot of courage. And sometimes we say that, oh, they're just kind of trying to game the system, they're economic migrants, they're trying to. Believe me, nobody wants to leave their home, unless they have to. And most of these people had to leave their homes. So, like I did mention, like Boko Haram in Nigeria, I did mention the ISIS situation in Syria, and we've all seen this on TV. That's the reason why these people couldn't stay in their countries, and now they have to. And imagine a mother going in one of these boats with her children. There's no love greater than a mother's love, but for her to embark on this dangerous journey, you have to understand that she's super desperate. She's trying to get a better life for her children. So that's the kind of sacrifice that they make. And no danger is too much for them to face just to get to a place, a new home, that they can call, that they can feel safe.
Three of these kind of interconnected stories in the novel are connected by one boat trip from Libya that goes down. And I want to just read a little tiny bit and ask you about it. This is towards the very end of the book. And this is a character, Jamu, I believe. Is that how you say his name?
Yeah.
Jumo, I'm sorry, who is writing a letter, and he says, "Later, I learned that of the over 300 of us who left Libya that morning, only me, the man, and the girl, and five other people survived. Why did I survive?" And I felt like these characters are often dealing with, besides for all the horrors that they have had to see, or personal or political, but they're dealing with survivor's guilt to some extent, and that's combined with hope. And I wonder if you talk about that combination, because sometimes they do have this guilt, but they have to look forward, right? They've come to Europe to create a new life. And how does that go together with the people that you talk to, and also in your characters, this combination of guilt and hope?
Yeah, that's the tragedy of this situation, is that when you see these people, you see them as if they're whole, you know, that they're just, all they need is little food and a place to stay. But there are layers and layers of trauma that they went through, and you can't even begin to scratch the surface of it, you know? One of them is the survivor's guilt, but the actual experience of nearly drowning and seeing your loved ones dying or a child dying, this affects them mentally. The mental health is going to be there for the rest of their lives, you know? And there's nothing you can give them, you know, that can make them forget that or that can cure that trauma. It takes time. So I think people are beginning to understand that. And that's why all these workers, the NGOs, are so important. Apart from just giving them permit to work, you also need to counsel them and to really give them mental health treatment. I give an example, and there are different levels of this kind of trauma. And they all try to find different ways to deal with it. One example I give in the book is the academic who lives Zambia, I think, and moves to Europe. And he doesn't want to hear about his country anymore. He doesn't want to go back. He's left his family. And that's one way of coping, you know. Some people leave their country and they don't even want to hear about it. They don't want to hear the name of the country. They've left it behind. Everything about it is just there. It's wiped out. It's one way of coping with leaving your home. Another way of coping for these people is to pretend that they are going back tomorrow, that everything here is temporary and they cannot really build a life here because they are always planning to go back. And they could be there for years, 10 years, 20 years, and they never really integrate into the new society. So these are the extreme examples of ways that people just kind of try to cope. And when you look into it, you see that it's something that's psychologically caused by the rupture, you know, from home, which is the most painful thing that can happen to anyone, I think, to leave your home without any prior plan, and you're just here now, trying to fit in, to translate yourself into this new place.
And of course, very often you're in a hostile environment, you know, I mean, people aren't always welcoming. And in fact, that's an actual official term that the British government have created, hostile environment, to make it so difficult for people to be there that they are trying to discourage them. And when we said in the broadcast interview that very often Britain, the UK, is the end point in people's minds when they're getting on these boats to cross the Mediterranean, the British government don't want them. And they're doing everything they can to stop them. As I said, that's an official policy, hostile environment.
Yeah. That was under Theresa May when she was the Home Secretary. That was the policy that they invented, hostile environments policy, just to be as unwelcoming as they can in order to dissuade people from coming. And we don't have to go that far. You know, we saw it in the last 4 years here, where kids were thrown into cages and all that. And it was clearly the government said that that's what we're trying to do, to dissuade them, to discourage them by making it as painful as we can. So that's what these people are kind of negotiating when they come to this places. And, you know, they are Black, they are different. So imagine that you feel you stick out already. And then there's the government sanctioned policy of making you a target. And you have to go through that every day. So that was the mental challenges, apart from the other numerous challenges they were going through. It's crazy.
Once people are here, they of course face racism in Europe and in the United States. And in the book, there's a conversation at a party where they're almost comparing racism in Germany with racism in the United States, with of course the Germans saying it's not as bad here. Look, they didn't even like Obama, you know, like, you know, like. And I wonder if you could talk about that, because then they give a couple examples and it doesn't seem through the examples they give that the racism is all that different between the two places.
Yeah, I mean, racism can never be good or bad, you know? No, racism is racism, you know? And it's just like a little step and it increases until it gets violent. It's a way of seeing people, I guess. Once you see people as other, then everything is allowed. You are free now to be racist to them once you begin to distance yourself from them. And it doesn't matter whether they are the president, you know, we saw what happened, you know, with, you remember the beer summit at the White House, yeah. When Steve Gates, this powerful professor who was trying to get into his house and was arrested by a policeman in front of his own house just because of the color of his skin. So it doesn't matter who you are. And I think that's the point Obama was trying to make, that, you know, it's just this way of seeing people. As long as they are not like you, you just assume that they're inferior or they're different, and you really can't step into their shoes and think like them and see the world like them. And that's about that, I think, is one of the magic of books, that books can actually take us into the lives of people. And it does this, I think, more than any other art form, to really see these people just like they see themselves, you know, as fathers, as mothers, as just ordinary people who are going through their own challenges. And it becomes your duty, you know, that to help if you can. And that's the first step to see. Then you realize that, yes, they're human beings and they deserve help, because I could be like them tomorrow. You know, there go I, but for the grace of God. That's it.
That's why I think your book is so powerful and so important, because you do show the humanity, the people's stories behind this. Because I do think, as part of, you know, various different governments' attempts to stop migration or stop asylum seekers coming, they create various different degrees of hostile environments, albeit that's the official policy in Britain, or was. And part of that is to create a monolithic, you know, image of what a migrant is. It's all the same, they're faceless, it's an entity, you know. And the dehumanizing language then that we see, you know, it's an invasion, Europe's being invaded, and that then lends itself to these policies and support from people. But the reality is, it's very difficult to get to know people, I think, in who are in these situations, because of how they are housed and how they are sometimes incarcerated, and they are kept completely apart from society. And so that sort of creates this whole cycle, it seems.
Yeah, that's what makes it so difficult and sometimes frustrating, when you begin to hear these stories of NGOs who are working with these people. And that's why I admire them so much, because these are really good people who are working every day to make sure that they protect these people, and they have different stories to tell you about these people, about what they experience and what the government is doing. For instance, they could be charged as criminals, you know, or MS-13, you know, here. They go to arrest a person and they immediately label them thug or gang members, and they are not. But they say, when you ask them, they say, oh, it's easier for the judge to deport them when we label them thugs or gang members. That's the ultimate aim. You know, so you don't see this person what he needs, you don't listen to their stories, you don't understand why they're leaving their homes. Your only objective is to get them sent back home. And that's the rationale. And for them it's logical, because that's what we're trying to do. That's what they're trying to do. So it's crazy. And there are different degrees. Like I said, it's not all of them that are bad people. There are really good people who are also working with them, like church organizations. So even cities of asylum that are trying as much as they can to help these people. And it's becoming more and more a feature of our world, that people are going to be needing this kind of assistance more and more as climates change. Some countries are going to be uninhabitable, you know, like the Gulf regions and all that, in the next 40, 30 years because of climate. So it's going to be a staple part of our lives that we have to deal with, whether we like it or not.
So, Halaan, I wanted to ask you about a different project that you did. And it's the way I discovered you. You edited the volume, The Granta Book of the African Short Story, which brought together, I think, almost 30 different writers from all over the continent, and really featured a lot of amazing stories. I feel like every time I read a few of those a year, it seems like, and every time I go back to that book, another writer has been kind of been discovered by US publishing, you know. But here they were in this book that I think came out 5, 6, 7 years ago, maybe more. I'm not even sure how long ago. But can you tell us about putting that book together, maybe what you discovered about African your fellow African writers through that project, and just if you're staying in touch, and what your role is in doing that.
Yeah, I was and you know, that was one of the hardest things I had to do. It's not easy dealing with authors, I promise you, you know, as an editor. Oh my God. Yeah, it was not easy. And I don't think I'm going to edit any book anymore, or not soon. Because you have to write to these individual authors and wait for them. Some of them will not even reply and you have a deadline. It was a nightmare. But I'm glad I did it. I was contacted by Granta in England, Granta Books, and they wanted to. So this was when African writing is kind of beginning to become, you know, more prominent, if you like. I mean, it's always been there, but now there are all these exciting new voices emerging and people don't really know them. So they wanted an anthology that would put these writers in, you know, in one book with a little introduction. And they contacted me to do that. And my approach was to try to organize the book in such a way that Africa is, you know, the geographic Africa, not usually Africa is so divided. And when you find anthologies of African writing, it's either you find the Francophone writers in one volume, or you find the Anglophone writers in one volume, or North African, you know, Maghreb writers in one volume. So I wanted to go beyond that. So actually some of the stories in that anthology were not written in English. We had to translate. So that was another layer of difficulty. We had to choose a story and translate it. Then sometimes we'll find out, no, we don't really like the story after being translated. And we have to pay the translator and then throw away that story and start all over again. So it took me years to put that book together. But I'm glad, like you said, most of the writers I chose were kind of very much unknown. And then now they're the big names that we talk about when we talk about African literature. We talk about people like Chimamanda Adichie, for instance, was in that volume. Not that I discovered her, I mean, she was quite well-known, but not to the level that she is now. Right. People like Binyavanga, the late Binyavanga Wainaina, is also in that book, and so many more.
Maza Mengisti is in the book, and she came to Boulder, and I was lucky enough to interview her when she was here. And then her book was nominated for the Booker Prize last year. And, you know, this book came out years and years ago. So when I first picked up this volume, I had no idea who she was. And now she's become big. What do you think? I mean, this is a big question to ask you, but since you did this volume, I fear you're the best person to ask. What do you think of this state of African writing? Not just in Africa, let's just say it's always been there, but its prominence worldwide. And are you heartened by where it's going and what's happening? Or you think there's a lot more that hasn't been discovered that needs to be discovered by the Western world, European and American readers?
Oh, there's much, much more to discover. African writing, what makes it so interesting, you know, it's the evolution of it, you know, and the way African writers are kind of discovering new themes and subject matters, almost breaking out of the old traditional way of storytelling that you had with people like Chinua Achebe, for instance, or Wole Soyinka, and the first generation, as we call them, writers, who were more obsessed with the idea of the nation, you know, and politics, and the writer as someone who is bringing the nation into being. This was just after colonialism, and they wanted to contribute to nation building. So most of them are kind of so serious and so political, almost not fun, if you like, you know? Sometimes you study them almost as textbooks because they are just so concerned with the idea of the nation and nation building. So now you find younger writers who, some of them don't even live in Africa. They're all over the world and they're writing on different subject matters. When you look at, books like Old Drift, I don't know, I'm trying to remember the name of the author, but you know, experimenting with form, with genre, some are writing sci-fi. So you don't have to write like Shakespeare or Dickens to be interesting. They are writing in all forms, but most importantly, they are setting their stories, not just inside Africa, but also outside of Africa. So kind of in a way, expanding the idea of what it means to be African, expanding the idea and challenging the idea of boundaries and borders as designed by the colonial government. Now they've gone beyond that. So Africa has kind of really enlarged and morphed. And you can see that best when you read the books of these writers.
Who are you reading right now?
Ooh, I teach, so I'm always reading for work. Yeah. I'm trying right now on my bedside. Before I came downstairs, I was trying to read Remembrance of Things Past by Proust. I've been reading that book for the past 10 years and I'm still on like page 20. So, so I'm doing my best.
Good luck. You've a ways to go, but not to worry. Well, it's been a joy to talk to you, Helen. It's been an incredible joy to read your book, Travellers. As we have said, it's a beautifully written collection of stories. Helen Habila has been our guest at After Hours at the Radio Book Club. But please do listen to the other interview as well, because we dig into a lot more of the book itself, but so much to talk about. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. It's been fun.
Well, After Hours at the Radio Book Club is a collaboration between KGNU Community Radio and the Boulder Bookstore. I'm Maeve Conran with KGNU. As always, my co-host, Arsene Kashkashian of the Boulder Bookstore. Thanks, Arsene.
Thank you, Maeve.